This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we talk with writer Norma Martyr about rape. She was raped while a college student. She was 19 years old. The rape happened on a blind date. The rapist, a newspaper reporter, an African American, and after the rape, while Norma Martyr lay unconscious, the rapist wrote poems filled with violent metaphors and left them in her apartment. Some 40 years later, Norma Martyr began writing an essay about the rape, about what happened and its impact. It took years to write. The essay, titled Blind Spots, appears in this summer's edition of the literary journal The Gettysburg Review. Listeners, you're welcome to join the discussion with your questions and comments this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about our guest. Norma Martyr is the author of the novel An Eye for Dark Places. Her stories and essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Gettysburg Review, and Literal Latte. She received an Illinois Arts Council Literary Fellowship, and her work has been listed in Pushcart Prize, Best Short Stories of 1995, and Best Essays of 1995. Excuse me, I'm losing my breath. For many years, she sang avant-garde music in New York and the Midwest. She recently completed another novel and is working on a collection of short stories and memoirs. Norma Martyr, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
My apologies for losing my voice here.
You want my water?
I will take a sip of coffee here in a moment. Well, let's begin with the beginning. Tell us simply what happened.
Well, I was 19. I was at Brandeis University. I was living off campus for the first time, and I was having my first serious love affair, and that ended. And my roommate and I were living in, I guess you might call it a flop house. It was a really, really cheap rental place, and everybody else in the building was an alcoholic. Except for my roommate and I, we had this little apartment, and it puzzles me now why we, you know, allowed ourselves to live in this grotty place, but we did, and the apartment was fine. It had, you know, a fair number of rooms, and we were very comfortable in it, but all around us were alcoholics of various ages, and including a man upstairs who'd just been released from jail for having beat up a policeman. So that was the surround. And but there we are, you know, very privileged and going to this fine university. And sometime after I broke up with my boyfriend, my roommate's boyfriend arranged a blind date. And the guy arrived, and he was older than I was. Older, I mean, he was 28, which just seemed enormously older. Mm-hmm. And we were sitting in my room, and everything in my room was brown. The walls were brown, the floor was brown, the curtains were brown. I had one of those brown bait spreads, I remember, with the little ridges in it, and one lime green rocking chair, and the blind date sat in the lime green rocking chair, and I sat on the edge of my bed, which was also my couch, and we talked for, I guess, about 3 minutes. And he said he was a journalist and, you know, a certain amount of trouble, the press, and, you know, they didn't let him write features. Mind you, I have changed all this. His name has changed. Mm-hmm. His exact profession has changed. He was a journalist, but is what I say he is in this piece. Not allowed to write any features, just courthouse and stuff. And then I said, well, how do you feel about that? And at that point, he leaped out of the chair and he raped me. And I discovered after a few seconds that if I moved around and I fought him, it made him very happy. So I lay there like dead meat, and I literally floated out the window in my mind. And I was a singer then already. And I floated out the window singing Schubert songs with piano accompaniment. Gretchen am Spinnerad, Litany, Nacht und Träume, and then I would pass out, and I'd wake, and I'd pass out, and I'd wake, and it seemed as if it went on for hours. I can't tell you how long it went on. And the last time I woke, he was sitting on the edge of this bed, this couch, and he was scribbling on a piece of paper that was on his thigh. So my image of him, which is very clear, is him hunched over and scribbling on this piece of paper. And I said, "Do you always write poems to women after you rape them?" And that's the only time he threatened me. You know, he just raised his fist over my head and shook it. And look, his face was completely contorted and enraged. And then he left. And after that is when my memory gets fuzzy. And I think I scrumbled up the bedspread and threw it in the corner. And I thought for about 40 years that I had scrumbled up this poem and threw it in a wastebasket. And after that, I remember absolutely nothing. I don't remember talking about it to anybody, though surely I must have. I just don't remember anything. And then I didn't talk about it. As I say in the essay, I mentioned it once to my husband, and he was just furious that I hadn't screamed. And it took us many years to sort that out. And then about 20 years went by, and then Susan Brown Miller wrote her book, Women Against Rape, and a voice student of mine was raped. And then I began talking about it a lot. And then I had been a singer. I'd sung classical music and avant-garde music. And in 1980, I just quit. And I rented a typewriter in England, and I began writing. And so my closet in my study began to fill up with an awful lot of stuff. I mean, there were all the tape recordings that I'd made for many, many years. And on the top shelf, and it's important because this closet somehow is a metaphor for things. And the top shelf was a lot of music. And there was a folder that I've had since 1954, I guess. And it's one of these leather folders. It's made out of deer skin. And my aunt had given it to me. It was a souvenir from Florida. And in it has a lot of old letters. And the thing, you know how you have some things, and you just find them. And one day they're in a box, and then you find it 10 years later, and it's in a trunk. And well, it surfaces now and again. And every time it surfaces, I open it up, and I leaf through it, and I look at all these wedding letters and things, and a letter from some boyfriend who said, "Well, you promised me you'd get married in white jeans. I hope you've kept your promise." And my first singing contract. And so I was, you know, already a writer and had some things published, and I was going to be on TV at Sangamon State. And my makeup, you know, I don't wear makeup much as a writer, but I was going to be on TV. So I was hunting in this study closet for my makeup, and leafing around, and there's this folder again. It surfaces, and it's deer skin. It's got a flamingo on the cover, and it's on the back. It's got my name heat engraved in calligraphy, and I open it up, and I leaf through it like I always did, and then all of a sudden, this time, and this is about 6 years ago, I noticed that in the back cover, there was a slit across the top. And I had leafed through that many, many times, and I had looked at that back cover many, many times in those 40 years. I'd never seen that slit. And there it was. So I put my hand in.
Yeah. And tell us exactly what was in there. The poem?
Okay. Inside the slit were two flattened wads of paper. And I took out the two flattened wads of paper, and I opened them up. Do you want me to read this part, or do you want me to talk about it?
I want you to read it, but I want you to I want to set it up just a little bit more.
Okay.
You find these things, and as you refer to them in the essay, if I'm remembering correctly, you think of them as letters from the dead.
Okay. When I reached my hand into the slit, I thought, gosh, you know, it's really strange. I've got this folder, and it's got all these letters and telegrams about our wedding, and everything's from friends. There's nothing in here from my parents. And so maybe there's stuff there from my parents. I put them really in a special private place. I can't understand why I haven't noticed it all these years, but maybe that's where they are. My father had died many, many years ago. My mother was still alive. But for some reason, I thought of them as letters from the dead. And I reached my hand in and pulled out these two, you know, flattened wads, because they'd been in there for 40 mm-hmm. years. And do you want me to talk about that also before reading it, or I can do it any way you like?
Well, I'd like you to, read an excerpt from the essay about remembering and connecting and finding these pieces of paper and finding this poetry that he wrote. And this part of the essay begins, I believe, on page 224.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Okay, so imagine this deerskin folder, and it's the inside cover is red. It's a blood red, and it's pebbled cardboard. And so imagine something very, very stiff and sticking your hand inside and finding something in there. I reach in and pull out two flattened wads of paper. The first is relics from my first college love affair. A drawing of my lover's sleeping face, a drawing of myself looking sad, my poems neatly written on index cards. I see the desk in the brown room where I tried to turn misery into art, drawing my hair, finding images for lost love, a stopped clock, a rose growing in sand. I unfold the second wad. A faded poem begins, "I guess this was the worst I could have done. It is dedicated to me, and signed in a florid scrawl, Tom Lena." I gasp for air, cling to externals, torn notebook paper and scraps of stationery, wobbly script in faded ink and pencil, titles and dedications. Five poems I have never seen before, have no memory of ever seeing before, yet at the bottom of one page, the rapist's name and the date are neatly recorded in my own hand. Tom Lena, February 11th, 1955. I refold the papers, unread, along their original creases, and fold my hands over them. 40 years ago, these interlaced fingers tucked these papers away and mentally sealed the compartment like a pharaonic tomb. I stopped seeing the entrance. The seer forgot to see. Was I keeping the poem secret, safe? A mystery of selective blindness, as if the compartment itself had a will, as if it willed its own invisibility and discovery. The lover whose sleeping face I drew used to say the essence of the good life is the proper timing of proper events. The singer couldn't use this material. The writer can. Next morning I devour the poems, then read critically, taking notes. Having expected letters, I call them letters from the dead. Quote, "There was not enough of ecstasy to make the death knife keen. Cruelty is life, and kindness death." Unquote. So this is amnesia, this thud in my mind, a padded mallet beating on a stone wall. Why do I remember the rape, but not the poems? I scribble in my journal. Indexing, I write. A traumatic experience shatters into emotional fragments, each filing itself in a different folder deep in the system. If I knew which menu hides the poems and which emotional or linguistic keys to press, I could open a neural path and remember. Shame, I write. Shame conspires with forgetfulness. We who've suffered at the hands of sexual criminals execute ourselves in the dark. Silently, we hang ourselves. A child raped in the park doesn't tell her mother. A woman raped years ago by her father won't tell her sister. Raped women who file charges make headlines. Most of us can't bear exposure. We displace. We distort. We create. We hang from our imaginings. But this is theory, and I want emotion. As a child, I did eye exercises at the optometrist's every Saturday morning, staring into a 3D viewer at cartoons of objects that needed to be joined. Week after week, I strained to slide a suspended vase of daisies over to a blue table. Sometimes the vase came close, sometimes it landed for an instant, then sprang away. I must attach the poems to the man. I must attach the poems to myself. My mother believed if you sit on a needle, it will enter your body and travel. and eventually strike your heart.
Norma Martyr, reading from her excerpt an excerpt from her essay Blind Spots, which appears in the summer 1999 Gettysburg Review. Talk with us, if you would, now about the process of trying to attach to the poems.
Gosh, well, it took 6 years. Because something like this is neither interesting nor useful, I think, if it's just a confessional. So I wrote it first just to get it all out, and then began to ask, well, what's most useful and why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me this is an extraordinary and rare opportunity to examine the mind of a rapist. Because after all, how many rapists mm-hmm. leave poems behind? And as a writer, you know, I know how to deconstruct. I know how to read between the lines somewhat. And so I set out to write the poems, which I find truly hideous. And there are people who read them and say, well, you know, these are a lot better than you give them credit for. But to look into them and say, what's here and what does it tell us? And the most striking thing about this particular guy is his conversion, so that for him, the victim is the aggressor. And there's poem after poem in which the woman is responsible for the rape, and he is just a mm-hmm. poor, innocent victim. I had wanted originally to tie his poems into pop lyrics, but it's too expensive. I mean, permissions for pop lyrics are extraordinarily expensive. So I had to get rid of that. But, you know, lines like, you know, she made me do it. You made me love you. I didn't want to do mm-hmm. it. That's an innocent version. Mm-hmm. But there, you know, I'd hear things on the radio or at friends' houses, you know, extolling cruelty. The woman really wants to be taken by force, and that's made into a song. And it seemed to me that these poems have a lot in common with just a, you know, popular ethos in which, you know, the woman wants to be taken by some marvelous animal, and to force yourself on her is really grand. For him, though, because he doesn't come by and large. He didn't with me, and he doesn't in his poems. He talks about cruelty mm-hmm. as being the energizing factor, and he's always circling and he's always cycling, and he has certain images that repeat themselves, like ivory moths and battlements, and the woman is some sort of a sarcastic creature in armor on top of battlements, and she is both seducing and fighting the poor man who lies beneath the battlements, whereupon, like, he'll knock her off her pedestal and yeah. then he'll be very scornful of her. I found a certain Wagnerian idea of transformation, where April, being the cruelest month, is the time when he awakens and he takes his knife again and he brings it to bear against a woman again in the great season of spring, mm-hmm. the flowering of evil for him. And it was very hard for me to do that, because to do it and to attach the poems to me, I had to admit that I had been touched by something evil. And I'd always said, oh, I'm so tough. You know, this has happened. I floated out the window. I sang these songs. You know, nothing like this touched me. And then, oh, yes, of course, I should have mentioned this a long time ago. What I did trade, there's had no effect on my sexual life or my personality in any way, but it did have one effect, and that is that as a musician, I would get lost in music when I performed it, but I didn't get lost in it when I heard it. And the summer after I was raped, I was a student at Tanglewood. And I remember lying on the grass, and I was listening to Beethoven's Second. And the second movement is just this really ethereal, quiet movement. And literally, I felt as if I were lifted up off the grass, off the blanket. And at the end of the movement, I sank down. And I've never, ever been lifted up again in that way. And I had a friend here in town who's a French horn player, and we used to listen to music together. And once I confessed to him, at that point it was like my deepest, darkest secret that I didn't get taken away by music, me, you know, a musician. And I said, you know, I confess this to you. We listen to music, but you know, you're just transported by it. I know, I see that, and my husband is a people, but I don't. And as I said that, I don't really get taken away by music. All of a sudden, I remembered having been raped. And I said, I wonder if there's some connection. And he said, write it up. And I did, and that was really the beginning.
So one of the things taken.
Yeah. That was that. That vehicle for escape remained a personal escape. So I'm lucky. It didn't affect my sexual life, but it affected my ability to listen to music.
Yeah. I would imagine people listening this afternoon would be curious about this, about anger. Did you get angry?
No, and I've written a whole other piece, and that was published in Literalate, which is a New York journal, and it's called Don't Put Words in My Mouth. And it was a whole segment of this essay, but the essay was just, it was too long, and so I extracted that. And the answer to that was no, and that whole piece is about the fact that anger is in fashion for women, and we are supposed to get angry.
Right.
We are
Jermaine
just supposed
Greer
to have anger.
Time to get angry.
That's
again.
Right. And I didn't. But, of course, as with everything else, and that's why it's blind spots. I mean, there's selective amnesia, and there's also displacement. And so there's displaced anger. There are times when somebody tries to reroute me, like somebody tried to reroute me on the way to a football game. And I never scream at anybody. I mean, it's just not something that I do. And I roll down the window, and I started screaming at this poor traffic cop. You know, how dare you reroute me 7 blocks? I got to go someplace. How dare you? And I was just horrified and shocked at myself. And things like that have happened if I'm rerouted. So maybe rape does reroute us. And that's the displaced anger that comes up.
Also, one of the things I was really touched by reading the essay is the sense of betrayal you felt by this man who set you up on this date.
Whoa. Yes. Yes. And if there's a special place in hell reserved for the rapist, there's another one for my roommate's boyfriend. And I don't know what he was doing. He knew this man was a rapist. And as I say in the essay, he said to me, so that's how I know I must have spoken to somebody about it. Mm-hmm. He said, oh, yeah, you know, Tommy has a habit of raping white women when he feels they're being condescending. So my question, how do you feel about that, clearly was perceived as condescending. And look, I would have kept out the fact that he was African-American, or black, as I say. But the piece just didn't make sense without it. So yes, I honor the entire history and of it all. And yet no one has a right to take out his personal or political anger on another human being in this way.
Yeah. I just want to read this one little spot, if
sure.
I might, from the essay so that listeners can get a sense of this. It was 1955.
Yes.
And you write, I felt the political edge.
Yes.
Perhaps that is why I didn't get angry, didn't feel the rape was directed at me personally, though you could argue I had a creative relationship with denial. Anyway, daughters of leftists were afraid to be investigated and would never get a black man in trouble.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a little dream in there. So I don't remember screaming, but there's that dream which I had while I was writing the essay about screaming and this sort of phallic figure that is bouncing up and down on one hand in an alley, and I'm in my bra and underwear, and I run around saying it's no different than wearing a bathing suit, and I'm, you know, held in a vise by this short, chunky man. So perhaps I did scream. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no memory of that.
On page 225 of the journal, there is his poem, Sophisticated Lady, which is really telling. And if it's not too difficult, maybe you'd share that with us.
You want me to read that whole one? Okay, so this is the first poem that I analyze, and it's the one that I see as a sort of nightclub piece. Sophisticated Lady. I burned up when I watched your cool indifference, while red-tipped fingers tapped a cigarette. Your smile, the unborn yawn, were almost insolence, and I swore that love would hurt you yet. I thought at first no line could breach your indifference. You parried speeches with one frosty word, and then you fell, of course, with poised magnificence. Your cooing is now quite the worst I've heard, and I could laugh, but by some strange coincidence, I think I loved your goddamn cool indifference. And that's where I write about, you know, the sadism and the sadistic tone that leaks through the paradoxes of hot and cold, and the sadist twisted consolation that his victim is the aggressor.
So much hatred there.
The hatred is in all the poems. And that's why, I mean, you ask, how do you write something like this? The hardest part was to say that, you know, this man is so full of hatred, and that entered me and that touched me. And you may remember there's a place where I say, well, what does it feel like? Because, you know, there's this discrepancy, always this. I'm writing this essay on this gorgeous island where I live in the summer. You know, and it's the most beautiful place on earth. And I'm looking out at the sea and the sky, and I'm writing about this most horrendous stuff. And at some point, I just remembered what a friend of mine had said about chemo, and that I felt just bloated and dirty just thinking about it and writing it. But I had to imagine it. I had to go way, way down in myself to imagine what it had felt like to be raped and not escape from it, at least while I was writing it, and really feel what it was to be touched by evil. And, yeah.
We're talking with Norma Marder this afternoon. We're talking with her about rape. She wrote an essay titled Blind Spots, which appears in the Gettysburg Review, the summer 1999 issue. If you've just joined us, this is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I want to go to what I think is so important about this essay. Maybe it is the heart of the thing. If you would read, this has to do with language, and it appears at page 229. It is late in the essay, relatively late, and it is a point where we start to really feel with you making sense, making the connection, the attachments, sort of having everything incorporated, if that's a way to put
sure.
it. It's very difficult to attach language to all of these feelings and issues.
It's very difficult, and I don't ever want to be false, if I can help it. And finding language for this when there's a public language around for it
right.
that I can't use, like, you know, I can't use the word victim or survivor, I can't use any of that public language. So it's hard to talk about it. And talk about it in an honest way, because I don't want to join a more common collective. I've heard people talk about rape and listen to them read their pieces, and it's, for my taste, it's pure confession, but it doesn't go beyond confession, and I think I need to go beyond confession to say something useful about our system of beliefs.
Mm. Would you read that excerpt,
sure.
please?
How do we talk about atrocities and calamities? The current fashion is to embrace them with pronouns and possessive verbs. My abuse, my incest, my cancer, my surgery. A woman friend is both puzzled and pleased when her therapist suggests she might have abuse in her past. I can't remember any, she says, but he thinks I have it. To my ear, affirmation sounds greedy, and confession is tinged with a consumer's pride. Acknowledging one's terrible history can be useful, but why hug it like a teddy bear? Why collect griefs? What happens when owning up becomes owning? The possessive in suffering is essentially cliquish, denoting club membership. It is part of the peanut butter spread of calamity language, along with the labels victim and survivor. I am not a victim. I never felt like a victim. I wasn't sacrificed or destroyed, and the damage was less than others have suffered under worse conditions. I was young, but not a child. The man didn't threaten to kill me. The rape didn't open old emotional wounds. So I don't moan and groan about being raped. I can discuss it as if it were measles. I say this not to absolve any man or to criticize any woman, but to discourage pity. Pity keeps people in their places like noblesse oblige. Pity weakens. Idealizing pain weakens. Bad things have happened to me, and this isn't the worst. I sustain more injury from misogyny that is scattershot daily. So how do we talk about this without using labels? I can't use the words victim or survivor. Looking for language, I interview therapists on the island. They detest labels, but can't find other words. Labels blur experience, we agree. They are useful only for people who truly need to forget or who need to take comfort from communal language. I believe a battered or sexually abused child is a victim. A person hit by a drunk driver, falsely imprisoned, tortured, or murdered is a victim. People in wars of all kinds and all scales are victims, but only temporarily, only at the time. The word that applies when the atrocity ends, if the atrocity ends and the person lives, the word we use later, the afterword, eludes me. Some say survivor. I can't say rape survivor. It sounds congratulatory. Survivors have outlasted persecutions and massacres, have outlived serious accidents, natural and domestic disasters, and terrible illnesses and abuses. I understand the healer's impulse to substitute survivor for victim so people will feel courageous. But false positivism, I think, creates its own unhappiness. Surviving in itself has no moral weight. The wicked survive, too. How we endure is what counts, what we do to others and ourselves along the way. The words victim and survivor have lost their pungency. Along with abuse and vulnerable, they have become diluted and enriched, like orange drink, with added vitamins. Words speak us. I look for myself in dictionaries. Thesaurus synonyms for victim: sufferer, prey, loser, wretch, martyr. Thesaurus synonym for survivor: remainer. Webster's entry for victim: its Latin root victima is linked to witch, and its Gothic root vis means holy. A victim is a living being sacrificed to a deity, a creature immolated or made an offering of, a person injured, destroyed, or sacrificed. At this late date, I would be ashamed to face the world wearing a word so rich in persecutions, a word connoting injustice and martyrdom. When I try on the word victim, one chosen to die, I feel like the woman in Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, whose prize is death by stoning. Plain sentences suffice. I was raped. I am a woman who was raped. Language that blurs individual pain also blurs cultural misogyny. Sporting euphemistic tags, we mingle in life's revival meetings, singing hallelujahs to victimization and empowerment. Meanwhile, in the real world, nothing changes. Our enemies prosper. The minister of a small-town Midwestern church scolds mothers for wickedness and laziness in his Mother's Day sermon. On TV, a man beats his girlfriend with a soap-weighted sock. The recovery movement, linked to Christian ideals of redemption, nourishes the viper of misogyny by placing a value on owning one's pain. Adherents write phrases such as, "She had her abuse." Well, the rape is not mine. It belongs to no one. Ownership is irrelevant. I don't want comfort. I want a change in our belief systems. I sink into a stubborn part of myself and say, I was raped in college. Reactions, I find, vary by gender. Men wince or look horrified. Some sympathize. Some change the subject. A few lean forward, solicitous and kind, barely able to disguise their vicarious pleasure. Women share stories. We talk about rape corrupting the basic love instinct, turning pleasure into pain, connection into cancellation, perverting our basic impulse to participate, to join, to embrace, forcing us into a state of non-being, gouging us, emptying us, turning sex into nothingness.
Erasure.
Yeah. Well, the thing about rape is that it's a crime that is committed in a part of our bodies that is designed for connection. And so, enduring it, we have to pervert ourselves. We have to step away. We have to violate ourselves in order to not feel the rape. And in that very, very place that is designed for connection. It makes it different from being beaten up or stabbed or something. And all that is horrible, too. One would not want to have to choose.
Yeah. Do we need to rethink the public language of
I don't know.
Crime?
I think we need to rethink... We need to rethink our attitudes to women. We need to look into Proverbs and look at lines like, "Beware the woman with lying lips." We need to look at literature and see how women are portrayed. I am not in a position to legislate how other people use language. I just know what I will or will not say about my own experience. Some people, as I say, really do need to say victim and survivor because they're so damaged that they need the community of others who will use those words. But if you don't need that, I think it's good to find your own words for whatever happened to you.
Yeah. Tell us more about the reaction to the essay. Have there been new insights for you? As a result of talking to people who have read this essay?
Well, two reactions from friends surprised me. One from a man on Monhegan who is a Quaker gentleman and seemingly quite mild and reserved. And he said, "You know, I think that there's some of this in all men. I think there's something like this in me." And that surprised me. And then a friend of mine, a woman, said she thought that on a very deep level, perhaps all women really want to be forced. They want some sort of animal taking of themselves. Now, wait a second. No, I've got it in reverse. She thought that all men had some sort of an animal desire like that and wanted to force women. And certainly don't think so. Mm-hmm. No, not at all. I think that most of the people I know want some mutual experience and want to be received and do not want to be forced. But the popular entertainment is all about forcing. It's all about forcing.
Hmm. When did you decide you'd like to publish this?
Probably the minute I started writing it, because I saw it as revenge. I said, all these years, this material has hung around, all these years I've had this experience like millions of others, and I've never been able to do anything useful in the world with it. And once I started writing it, I thought, well, I'm going to write this, and I'm going to try to get it published, and I would like to have it reach as wide an audience as possible.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you?
Maybe the part about right from the outset, because
mm-hmm.
I would think that at a certain point, yes, you'd say, I want this to be out there.
I don't ever write, except for what I write in my journal, I don't write anything without wanting it to be published.
Mm. You're a writer.
I am.
That's what you do.
And I used to be a performer. It's what I used to do. So Yeah. There's always this outward thing, this wanting to be known, and that's in the latter part of the essay, this desire that... I grew up with secrecy. There were always secrets in our family. My mother's left-wing politics was a secret. My father wouldn't talk about how he came to this country. just recently I realized that my father's having said all his life that he was an atheist probably masked the fact that he was very, very religious, because he was a cantor, you know, in the synagogue, the one who sings, one of the two mediators between God and the community. And I always thought, well, he just does it. He does it as if he were singing arias. And about 2 weeks ago, I was realizing you can't sing prayers every Friday and Saturday night for 30-some years, sing all day on the high holy days without the role inhabiting you. And it occurred to me that was probably one of the deepest secrets of his life. While he was dying, he would read the Bible, and if somebody was coming down the hall to his room, he'd shove it under the pillow. So there was this enormous secret, I think, in my father. I lived with secrets all the time, and with doubleness. And just before I was raped, maybe just a few weeks before, a letter came from home with a newspaper clipping that my mother had been denounced, and her name was listed in the paper. 200 communists in the Lehigh Valley, and they misspelled her name. So I was able to say aloud for the first time in my life, my mother was a communist. And that was an enormous secret to tell. And so I've lived with secrecy and wanting to expose some things and yet having an access in me that wants to keep some other things secret. And keeping secrets, wanting also to be known. Is that too complicated to make sense?
Well, I think I might have to think about that again. I think I might have to get the tape out and replay that and think about that again. Meantime, since, you know, this has been quite a process. This is six years.
Yeah. I was writing other things as well, but...
Sure.
The question was of public language and private language, and it took that long to get the public and private language together. And the last thing I had to do to make it viable was to say that the man was black, because otherwise the piece didn't make sense.
Yeah. Interesting. Has your relationship to music changed since completing this and
nope.
having this published?
No. Not at all. But I just feel very, very satisfied that this is out in the world. But no, it has not changed my attitude to music.
Do you know what has happened to this man?
No, but certainly I went through every search engine 6 years ago that the University of Illinois could provide, and looked for him everywhere that where he could be professionally, and he doesn't exist. I looked for him in, who's who in Black America and who's who in journalism. He's nowhere. And I did finally find him in a phone book, because his name is very unusual. I call him Tom Lena, but his name is something else. And I found him in a phone directory in a city not too far from where this happened. So he's, as of 6 years ago, was alive.
Did you think about sending this to him?
Absolutely not.
No,
absolutely not. That kind of vengeance I do not want. I do not want to open up any doors for...
Yeah.
Now, do you want to talk about the latter part of the essay where I find that last letter from him?
Why don't you do that?
Well, you know, this piece had all been written, and in fact I'd sent it out, and I had an editor who kept it for 2 years. And during that time, one day my husband went again into my study closet and took down a box of papers, and he was looking for some things, you know, of his own, and found a bundle of my letters, and there were the lost letters from my parents, and I was very glad to see them, and this little envelope slipped out. And there was a return address above a religious organization in and the rapist's name, and it was addressed to me, and my name was misspelled. And I got into that same porous state that I was in when I first found the poems. And I opened it up, and there is a letter from him in verse, and it begins with the opening lines of one of my own poems. I guess I should explain to the readers.
Yeah, we're running quickly out of time.
You're quickly, okay, all right.
But yeah, so there had been an earlier effort on your part, and there had been sort of another connection.
That I know nothing about because I don't remember it. But there's just a letter from him in verse in which he asks me to forgive him for having raped me. And says, why do I complain about it so much? Why is it such a big deal?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you forgiven him?
Oh, I don't. It's just not an issue. Probably not.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I never will. No.
Thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Norma Martyr has been our guest. Her piece, Blind Spots, is in the summer 1999 edition of Gettysburg, the Gettysburg Review. And this is available in town. It's also available online at www.gettysburgreview.com. Treat that all as one word, .com.
And it's available, the issue of the Gettysburg Review is available at the Jane Addams Bookshop at 208 North Neal Street.
Again, thank you very much, Norma Martyr.